I'm so happy to see all of you to come down and look for us in the basement of the hotel. I'm thrilled. And I'm very excited to talk about a project that's also near and dear to my heart. I have nothing to declare. And like most of you in public health, we're mostly volunteer anyway these days. I'm going to talk about the Gestational Diabetes Collaborative, Better Data, Better Care. And this project would not exist if it were not for Michelle Owens-Gary, our CDC project consultant, and Adeline Yerkes, who, as she said, I'm joined at the hip. She's my partner in crime. She used to be the chronic disease director for Oklahoma. She's still very active in women's health affairs all over the United States. And indeed, if they'd let us travel, she'd probably be all the way around the world. But without these two people, we wouldn't have the project. Michelle's idea, and it's her support that's gotten us this far. We have other national collaborators, but technically we have CDC Division of Diabetes Translation and Reproductive Health. We have the National Association of Chronic Disease Directors and their councils, Women's Health and Diabetes, and we have the Association of Maternal and Child Health Kit Programs, MCH or AMCHIP. And I wish we'd find a way to do shorter names. That'd be a lot easier. We have internal partners, the usual suspects, chronic disease, the Diabetes Prevention and Control Programs, vital records. We did add WIC and Wise Woman and Immunizations, which are unusual partners for a sort of a diabetes project. And we have a lot of external partners. I don't want to go through them, but some of them that are kind of creative are mental health, the PROs, March of Dimes, Medicaid, and a lot of others. Hopefully you'll download our presentation and get some ideas of other partners. Our most important people are our states, Michigan, Missouri, and a special hats off to the Cardinals, North Carolina, Ohio, Oklahoma and the Chickasaw Nation, Utah, West Virginia, and we just added Alaska, Arkansas, and Florida. So we now have 10 states working on this project in the collaborative. Now, why a collaborative? Why not just do a program? Well, you may have noticed our ability to fund anything is decreasing. They're cutting all of your funds in public health. You have to do more with less. So it makes sense. No one can do anything alone anymore. So it's very important for us all to find partners who can help. And we've been very lucky to find many partners who will give us in-kind resources and support. It's been another reason we're successful. It also helps to extend our reach. MCH programs know people. They have customers. They have partners that chronic disease doesn't have. And chronic disease has some program expertise, some knowledge, and partners and connections that MCH doesn't have. So if you put us together, we can bridge the continuum of the lifespan to work on the GDM issues. It's cost effective, we don't duplicate, and best of all, the reason it's MCH and chronic is because a woman of childbearing age, when she gets pregnant, is a crystal ball into her future and what's going to happen to her with chronic disease. Pregnancy brings on manifestations. Some of them go away after the baby's delivered. Sometimes they don't. Many women don't have health care providers until they get to be 50 years old, unless they get pregnant. So this gives us an opportunity to bring women who do not have access to care into a health care situation. She can be screened for risk factors. She can receive preventive education. We can perhaps prevent chronic diseases. And how far more upstream can you go to prevent chronic disease that will happen in the offspring? So there are a lot of reasons to coordinate with MCH and chronic. Okay, why gestational diabetes? Well, we have about little over 4 million births per year. Conservatively speaking, about 200,000 women get gestational diabetes each year. So they're giving birth to at least 200,000 kids. If she had, those women with gestational diabetes are predisposed to type 2 diabetes for the rest of their life. She has over a seven-fold risk of developing type 2 diabetes, and a third of the women will not have an abnormal tolerance. They'll just keep their diabetes and convert to type 2, and the rest, about 50% of them, have a risk of developing type 2 within the next 10 years, about 50% of them. Not only that, but their offspring are just predisposed to early diabetes and obesity. So there are several reasons, and of course with the obesity epidemic, our gestational diabetes is rising, our kids are rising. I just noticed that about 35% of the kids within WIC in 2008 were overweight or obese, and they weren't even 5 years old yet. So we really need to look at this as a way to prevent type 2 diabetes and also childhood obesity. And the best part of all, in true public health fashion, as Michelle said, the conversion to type 2 can be prevented or at least delayed simply by changing your life. Well, simply, it's not simply, it's difficult. But it is inexpensive, but it isn't easy. You lose 7 to 10% of your weight. You exercise 30 minutes, 5 days a week. You can reduce your risk to convert to type 2 by more than 50%. So what we need are more places to refer our women so they can learn skills on how to do that, myself included. I think I better toss in a definition of JDM. It's impaired glucose tolerance that's first diagnosed during pregnancy, as a point of reference. The goals of our collaborative originally were just to identify and validate sources of data available to public health departments, because we kept seeing all different kinds of prevalence. And, you know, in most studies, you don't have a movable prevalence rate. So we wanted to know why is this? So that was our first goal. Then we looked at the data that we had collected. We looked at the literature and made recommendations to improve not only the data, but the quality of care for women with GDM. And now we're in the third phase of developing, piloting, and evaluating our interventions. We originally looked at a PRAMS question that asked, during your last pregnancy, did you have elevated glucose? And we noticed that we had a lot of women who said yes, but the birth certificates didn't always have a diagnosis of gestational diabetes. So we decided to look at the medical record and see why do we have all these different numbers. And we noticed right off the bat that one of the lessons we learned is that not all birth certificates are created equal. There are 20 states who are still not using the 2003 version. They don't break out gestational diabetes. So if you want to use birth certificates for that, you're out of luck. We also noticed that there were 38% of our cases in the 277 records we looked at that had a diagnosis of gestational diabetes, but it was not on the birth certificate. So if you use birth certificate data, you'd be missing almost 40% of your cases. So that's a big problem. And we noticed also one of the bigger problems is that there is not a gold standard for diagnosing or treating gestational diabetes. There are 5 very reliable international and national sets of guidelines, and they're all different. And so right now, we're in a situation like, pick a set of guidelines, adhere to it, at least understand in your state what your what are you basing your diagnosis on. But even if you can't get your diagnosis standardized, there are other things that we can do to address issues. But it's one of the reasons that we have such a movable prevalence rate. There's no gold standard. We're very hopeful that there will be shortly. There is also a lack of documentation on the prenatal records. We looked at the prenatal records, and we found that 56% of the women in those charts we reviewed, we couldn't figure out what their status was. Sometimes they didn't get a test. Sometimes they got a test, but it didn't have the results. Sometimes she had the results, and it was positive, but she didn't have a diagnosis. So we couldn't tell. That's okay, we're already up to 80%. Well, then we had 16.6% that had elevated levels, but there was no record of a follow-up. So she may have had a very bad case of gestational diabetes with very high glucose levels, but nobody would ever know because they didn't follow it to make a diagnostic test. We also learned that there's an underreporting of all maternal conditions on the birth certificates. This is well documented in the literature, not just diabetes, gestational diabetes, but also both gestational and chronic hypertension, many things. We also noticed that if the women did not have English as a first language or a second language, there was a lot of missing data. Often we didn't know what her family history was, what her personal history was, and quite often on discharge education it would just say language barrier. So this woman had very little information about her, and she received very little information. We learned a lot about the care our women were receiving by what wasn't there. Documentation of diagnosis and care on the prenatal, hospital, and discharge data are missing in a lot of the charting. Women may not even be tested appropriately. They may not receive the adequate test to be diagnosed. They won't receive the follow-up and education during pregnancy. Therefore, women may not even know they had gestational diabetes, and they won't understand that the risks for type 2 diabetes that they have for the rest of their life, or how to reduce the risk, or the risk for their children. Women who don't know they have GDM or understand the risk may not receive any directions about a postpartum follow-up visit to get a glucose test to see if her glucose has become normal. We found we found less than 5% of the discharge instructions for women who had a diagnosis of GDM had a referral and a reminder that she needed a glucose test when she went for her postpartum visit. When you ask women, why didn't you get a postpartum visit? They say, I felt fine. And if they're Medicaid, I missed the cutoff and I couldn't afford it, so I felt fine, I didn't need it. So if she doesn't know she has it, she doesn't know why she needs it, she's not going to get it. So the next time she gets tested, maybe when she's pregnant again, and she now has type 2, but she will be misclassified as GDM. Oh, I skipped one. Okay, so looking at the literature, we know less than 50% of the women with GDM will get a follow-up glucose test. Linkages between our OBGYN care and our primary care are missing. Women often just have the baby and they won't see anyone until they become pregnant again, or until they go through the change, or until they get sick with something. So it's very important that we get these women back into primary care. We also learned that women who've had GDM are less likely, and this fits in with some of your things, Michelle, they're less likely to receive information about weight management from their doc than women who did not have GDM. We learned that our OBGYN docs are not trained to take the responsibility to tell women, you are at risk, you have a lifetime risk, you really need follow-up, we need to test you now, you need to get tested again by your primary care doc in six months, and if it's still elevated, in a year, and if not, in 3 years. These are definite guidelines that are not being adhered to because they're kind of being kept as a military secret. So we've got to get this information out. Another thing we want to see that we've learned is that maternal needs to be put back into MCH. The emphasis is on a healthy baby, and it should be, you know, healthy. We do need healthy babies, but we need healthy moms too. We need moms. We need to care about mom's diabetes. We need to care about mom's blood pressure. We need to get her back and functional so she can take care of her family and herself. The primary providers are not trained to think of gestational diabetes as a lifetime risk. Often, if you're on your intake forms, you won't see history of GDM, just history of diabetes. They don't make a differentiation, and there is a difference. So our top 10 recommendations. We need to strengthen preconception care. Utah, one of our collaborative states, did a study on providers asking them about preconception care. What percentage do you think said they did preconception care? Well, in Utah, you've got to remember, our birth rate's twice that of the United States. So we're a little better than that. But we had almost 30% of the docs who said, we don't do preconception care. We asked why. And they said, well, because, we don't have a flag on the chart, and I forget. Or I don't have any educational materials. Well, we can fix that. We have them available. So we need to remind our providers that since 50% of our pregnancies are unplanned, every visit from a woman who isn't pregnant, who's of childbearing age, should have some preconception message in it, because you never know. We need to improve the GDM surveillance and data collections that we have. Prenatal clinics need to document their care. The hospital charts need to be accurately coded. Birth certificates need to be accurately transcribed. And hospital discharge data, again, needs to be adequately coded. We need to ensure that our providers understand the gestational diabetes issues and the care standards. And as I said, there are several guidelines, ADA, ACOG, International Diabetes Association, World Health. We came up with another one.
Preventive Health Services.
Well, they don't recommend testing at all because they say, we don't have enough evidence that testing women during pregnancy is beneficial. So I'm choosing to ignore them completely. Yes. But Ohio's doing an extensive provider practice, looking at what providers do now. And it's going to be published, and if any of you are going to the MCH EPI conference in December, they're going to report on it. And some states like Colorado and Missouri have a consensus committee in their state. So right now they're updating what they're going to recommend their state physicians do for guidelines until we get a gold standard for them, for GDM. North Carolina does a professional webinar every year. They're emphasizing postpartum follow-up and care because we have strong guidelines from both ACOG and ADA who do agree on postpartum follow-up. So until we can get a gold standard, at least we can talk about follow-up. And Massachusetts, who is not a collaborative state, but really has done a lot of work in this area, and West Virginia do summit planning conferences with all of their stakeholders and providers to help develop the plan for the year to address gestational diabetes. There are several wonderful resources available. All of our collaborative states have developed some exciting resources that are available on their websites. The Diabetes Education Program has a set of wonderful education pieces. ARC has some, has a whole manual on diabetes and pregnancy for both providers and patients. So we need to get that information out in any way we can, anywhere we can. West Virginia has an exciting project. They were able to raise their participation in postpartum visits from 50 to 89% and increase their postpartum testing orders by fivefold, up to 49%. So you know where they started at 10%. But they were able to do it by insisting on better documentation of the prenatal care they were providing. They got a resident champion. They developed postpartum and prenatal protocols for their staff. They did a chart flag. They did a postpartum visit checklist, educational materials in every room, standing orders for a postpartum test upon discharge. And now they're looking at having the lab services come to the clinic as opposed to turning their patient loose to perhaps go to the lab. So all of this has worked very well for them, and they can show improved. We have an exciting thing to tell you about in a minute about this project. We need to improve discharge planning. As I told you, less than 5% of the discharge plans had any reference to getting their glucose checked. We need to make sure that women understand their risk and know they really need a postpartum visit. They're Medicaid. They need to know it has to happen before 6 weeks. And that we need to make sure they understand they need some coaching if they're overweight. And indeed, 50% of our moms, according to the WIC data, were overweight or obese before they conceived. So we know that that's a problem. Several states have done postpartum mail-outs, New York City and Utah particularly. New York has a very nice track record. They started doing this in 2006. Utah's only been doing it for a year, but Utah has been able to increase their postpartum visits by 30% by this mail-out. And the mail-out materials look like this. They go to the mom within 2 weeks after she gives birth to every mom in the state who has GDM marked on her birth certificate, which means we're probably missing about 38%, right? But it's better than we had. This has the doctor's reminder card, a little magnet for the refrigerator, and a fact sheet. And it's increased it by 30% in 1 year. Some of our states are doing focus groups to find out attitudes, beliefs, knowledge of women who had GDM and what they're willing to do after the baby's born. The predominant belief is, once the baby's born, I'm fine. And this is not true. We're trying to find out how we can approach women. The results of these focus groups we use to develop better targeted strategies. And hopefully we will be able to get moms to be able to take better care of themselves and reduce their risk for the next baby. Several of our states have developed partners to give the same message everywhere you look. And as you can see, we've got text for baby all around here. We have three states doing that. West Virginia is doing a study in WIC, and they're going to refer women who have not been tested in WIC to a federally funded health center or a community health center to be tested. Some are partnering with immunizations. One side of the information is for women to be tested, the other side is for how to get her children immunized. Text for Babies, Outreach, Diabetes Educators are a wonderful network. Every one of our states has a website, and several have set up a GDM campaign for Mother's Day, for diabetes, for the November is Diabetes Month, right? And worked through WIC with that, and special populations like Latinas. Last but not least is to build our bridge between OBGYNs and primary care. Sweet Success, which is a California project, has developed a referral letter that the OBGYN can send out to a referred primary provider to try and get mom back into primary care. And any kind of ways we can think of to get her referred. Several of our health departments are looking at all of their clinics and making sure that a history of GDM is on every intake form, and especially including intake forms for kids. We're trying to get our pediatricians to look at a history of GDM as a risk factor for obesity in kids, so that will alert them to be aware and monitor their child, not only for obesity, but for type 2. You know, we're having type 2 obesity in kids 10 years old now. So it's very important. And when you consider the 30% of kids overweight and WIC and less than 5 years of age, we need to do something. The last lesson we've learned is that this is a really, it's moving, creative bunch of states. They work hard and they don't have much money. And I'm so proud of them. I can't believe I'm so emotional. But I eat, sweat, and dream about, you know, how do we get more money for these people? How do we help them do it? I'm so proud of them. Never have so many done so much for so many with nothing, with so little. So anyway, that's our collaborative. And we've got a new thing. One thing our state said they wanted, they want to keep learning, they want to keep sharing. So we have developed a national network. And if you would like to be part of our network, I just happen to have a way for you to sign up. Our next call is November 15th, And we're going to have a communications expert talking about how do we evaluate the effects of Text for Baby, of our media campaigns. How can we in public health on a shoestring budget do some evaluation of some of the things that we're doing? And we're also going to have West Virginia on to talk about that clinical improvement practice project they have, because they have developed a cookbook guide that will be on our website so that you can help all of your clinics, or some of your clinics who are interested in changing their practice, to use their cookbook and set up the same kind of system that they were able to use so successfully. So the call is November 15th at 1 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, and our website will be available with all the resources and all the links to hopefully all the national resources we can find, all the websites, and that will be up December 15th. So if you're interested, please sign up for the network, and also for her for the report that she talked about. And if you want to ask more questions, comment, or listen to me praise the states, you can download this and get my my information. My email is ware@chronicdisease.org. And if you want Adeline, you can get her at Yerkes, yerkes@chronicdisease.org. That's an easy email. Let us know. Work with us. We're very excited to keep going. Thank you.